Most business podcasts today focus on the 1%, the nationally known larger-than-life personalities, entrepreneurs, and celebrities with interesting business stories. Business Exit Stories shares the stories of the other 99% of unheralded entrepreneurs that own successful companies in manufacturing, retail, logistics, telecommunications, construction, food service, and in every imaginable type of business in every state and city around the country. These are the stories told by the deal makers that facilitate exits. These are the mergers and acquisition specialists, business brokerages, financial and wealth planners, CPAs, appraisers, and attorneys. By listening to their stories, you'll learn what the entrepreneurs and business owners they represent did right and what they did wrong when it comes to exiting their business through a sale or a merger. In fact, you'll not only learn how they avoided disastrous exits, but how they positioned their companies for an out-of-the-ballpark home run when they exited their business. And here's your host, Marvin L. Storm.
Today we talk to Tim Bellin, who is based in the Tampa, Florida area. Tim shares with us several transactions that have unique aspects to them. The first transaction relates to having the right person in the company hold a government-required license, such as a contractor's license, can have a negative impact on the value and the sale of a business, and what a business owner did to negate this issue. In another transaction, a potential buyer of a business was not fully transparent in what he disclosed to an SBA lender on their information request documents. After months of pursuing a deal, under the assumption that there had been full disclosure, and just before closing, the SBA lender performed their routine verification checks and did a background check on the buyer, only to find out that he had been convicted of a felony, a fact that was not fully disclosed earlier. Now, this issue would not have been a problem if the buyer had disclosed this fact, but since it was not disclosed, the loan was not approved. Now, there were early signs that there was something wrong when the buyer refused to deposit earnest money into escrow. Ignoring Tim's advice of not moving forward with the transaction unless earnest money was deposited in escrow, the seller decided not to require the earnest money deposit. As you listen to this episode, you'll find out how much money this cost the owner when the deal did not close. Hint, it was in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. Finally, Tim outlines how a contingent liability on the balance sheet, which is normally an issue for buyers and deals, actually turned into a positive. This transaction is a unique study on what sellers can do to manage the impact of contingent liability exposure as they prepare their business for sale. This is Marvin L. Storm with the Business Exit Stories podcast. Today, we're with Tim Bellin. Tim is based out of Florida, and we'd like to have Tim introduce himself and tell us a little bit about his business.
Hey, thank you very much, Marvin, for having me on. Once again, my name is Tim Bellin. I'm the owner of a BR business broker office located in Apollo Beach, Florida, a Tampa suburb. I have four agents in my office, and I would categorize us as being primarily a Main Street business brokerage office that we dabble in middle market deals here and there. I've been in the industry for about 7 years. And prior to that, I served for just under 22 years in the U.S. Army.
Well, thank you for your service. I'm sure that's given you a good base from which to operate your business brokerage here. So why don't we move right into chatting with some of the transactions you've been involved in, dealt with a lot of different types of transactions with different types of business brokers. So let's talk about specific ones that there's some great takeaways for our audience here, who generally tend to be business owners who are thinking about selling their business. So why don't we move into one of those transactions that was a little bit more challenging for you?
Well, I think the first one, Marvin, that I would talk about is, I'll categorize it as a trucking or auto accessory business that was located in the Tampa Bay area. And what was some of the interesting things about this business, I met with the business owner probably about a year and a half before we actually listed the business. And it came to find out that their financials weren't really in a very good state. They were running a lot of owner's perks or you know owner type things through their business, so it didn't really show the business very well. And so they took that to heart, and they actually cleaned up those things up quite a bit. And we eventually listed the business.
So when you say they cleaned these things up quite a bit, does that mean they cleaned them up going on a forward basis as they organized their accounting, or did they actually go back and start pulling things out of their financial statements for prior years?
No, they weren't willing to go that far as like amending tax returns, but for the, you know, probably from about the 18 months forward from when we first met, they changed radically. You know, and they quit doing those types of things through the business. They had very few personal add backs by the time we actually listed the business.
Well, that's good to know.
Yes, that was, and they really understood when we sat down and went through the valuation, and I was able to show them, you know, when we talked about the multiple of cash flow, how much more they could realize from a sales price, they bought into it.
So these owners of this trucking accessories business, had they been involved in a lot of other businesses? Did they come out of corporate America? Did they have MBAs? What kind of people were they?
Actually, this was a husband and wife team. They actually were high school graduates, which, you know, is somewhat irrelevant, but to just give some background. And this was actually a franchise. They were in this particular franchise, they were probably one of the first 10 people that came on board with this particular franchise, and they owned a franchise in another state, probably had it there for about 10 years, and then got tired of living in that state and decided they wanted to move to Florida. So they actually acquired the franchise rights for a new territory in Florida in the Tampa area, and they moved here, and they had been operating it. You know, by the time we sold the business, they had about 10 other years in this second location.
So it sounds like they were fairly young when they got involved in opening up their business.
Yeah, I'd say they were probably in their early 30s when they started.
So from what you've said so far, they probably built a really nice operating business, doing quite well.
Yeah, I think in the, you know, they were multi-million plus in sales in both locations. They were doing very well. They were one of the top producers.
So they had two different locations.
Yep, especially when they were in their first location. When they're in their second location, as they got, you know, more into the business, they weren't doing as well, but they still were, you know, towards the top of the folks that were in the particular franchise.
Sort of happens, you know, when you open up your first location, it goes gangbusters, and you think it's going to be easy to open up that second location, and it's a little bit different environment when you're running two locations, so that's not unusual.
Yep, not unusual.
But combined, they had a great business. So what was unique about this transaction that's made it a challenge?
Well, I'll go back to when we first met. You know, we, like other brokers, we ask a lot of questions up front and continually. And one of the things that came up when we first met them about, you know, 18 months prior to listing is that they were in a month-to-month lease with the landlord. And we explained, you know, that you know, it had some risks that came associated with that, but they did not want to address it, and they wanted to move forward on a month-to-month lease.
So did they perceive that the month-to-month lease was a good thing?
For them, they did, because, you know, and for some reason, if they maybe just wanted to walk away from the business or who knows what else might be, they didn't have that, you know, X number of years of lease hanging over their head in case they, you know, something might have happened. So, yep. So that was a business decision that they made that, you know, actually had some consequences later.
But in their mind, at least at the time, not being obligated for a long-term lease was a real plus in their mind.
Yep. And in our industry, you know, we believe, you know, there should be a minimum, you know, of 2 or 3 years of a lease with some options, really to help you have a more sellable business.
And in this case, as it got closer to selling the business and you went to the landlord with a buyer, I assume you brought a buyer to the table, and now you're dealing with the buyer, the seller, and the landlord.
Yep, we got the deal under a contract. And, you know, as part of the process and due diligence, we make an introduction of the buyer to the landlord, and they actually had a meeting. And at first we thought it was going well, but then later on the landlord was very upfront in that he had no desire to, in this case, it was going to be a new lease, and he was not going to sign off on a new lease with these people. So, you know, we had a dead deal.
So let me understand this. So the new buyers were qualified, right?
Yep. They were very qualified.
And the landlord said, I'm not going to approve these, even if we sign a new lease.
Yep. He was not going to sign a new lease. He just unequivocally, no, he was not going to sign a new lease. So, you know, we looked like we were going to have a dead deal. And yeah, it was, and going back to the importance of having some amount of the lease left. But in this case, the buyers liked this particular business well enough, or quite a bit, that during the process, they went out and found themselves a new location, and they felt very comfortable. This was an SBA loan as well, so they felt very comfortable that the loan was going to go through. And as we got closer to the end, they actually went out and found a new location and signed a lease. And a day after closing, they started moving the business.
Well, that's quite unusual, because generally in transactions like this, if you have a retail location that has been there, in this case, for 10 plus years, that's a real goodwill type of component of the value of the business. But in this case, would these buyers have another business, or where did they come from? What was their background?
They actually both worked in corporate America, so they had never owned a business before, but they were, you know, they had been in, you know, larger companies for a number of years. So, you know, I felt that they understood what they were doing, and, you know, they had been looking for a business for quite some time, and this was, you know, in their short list of the types of businesses that they liked, and they weren't able to find anything else. So they felt pretty comfortable doing this. And one of the other interesting things is that when we do deal with things like this, sometimes if the landlord will not assign or maybe write a new lease, is that oftentimes, you know, the seller may still move forward, or the buyer still may move forward, but they'll ask for a price concession. And in this case, they didn't ask for a price reduction either. They felt comfortable enough, and they liked the business, and they liked the sellers, and they moved forward and didn't ask for a price reduction, and they moved the business.
Well, that's tribute to the buyers really recognizing what they wanted, and that this business fulfilled their needs.
Yeah.
And they were willing to take on moving a business and relocating it because they believed in their ability to grow the business. Well, that's great. So what would be the real takeaway on something like this? It sounds like it would be a month-to-month lease. In most cases, it's not a good thing because it gives the landlord a lot of power.
Yeah, I guess I would tell your business owners out there that when they're, you know, when it comes time, or well, even before, but when it comes time, you know, when it really comes time to they're thinking about selling their business, first they need to just review their lease. We find so many owners that don't remember, you know, what they signed, you know, and find out how much is left on the lease. And, you know, we really do believe that there needs to be some, you know, at least 2 or 3 years left on the lease. And we also find a lot of business owners, they end up, they're personal guarantors on their lease, and they don't realize that. They don't know what that means. You know, so when they actually sell their business, and if something were to happen with the buyer and they can't make payments, you know, that landlord can come back to that seller to get payment, at least for some amount of time. So those are just a few things, but the lease is very important. And, you know, that landlord can kill a deal very quickly.
Well, I really believe that the great takeaway on this is that you may think a month-to-month lease is a good thing, but in most cases, as it adds value to your business in a retail setting where the location is important, it is not a good thing not to have a longer-term lease, because it just gives the landlord too much power to control the outcome of a transaction that may end up costing you a lot of money, because if the lease rates go up, probably there's going to be a price concession pushing the price of the business down. So that's a good takeaway there. So let's talk a little bit about another transaction that was a little challenging, and have you outline that for us.
Well, another one was we sold a couple of day spas.
Day spas, meaning like facials and massages and things like that?
Pedicures, manicures, yes, those types of things. And this was a very interesting business in that it had two locations. The owners were semi-absentee. You know, between the two of them, they probably worked about 20 hours a week in the business. And they were doing, you know, multi-million dollars in sales a year, and were pulling down.
So is this business something they had started from scratch, or did they buy an existing business?
Actually, they had started it from scratch. It was a good point that you brought up, that it was a husband and wife again. And the wife had worked in the industry, and the husband worked in something totally different, in the telecommunications. And they saw opportunity for a little bit different concept, that they went a little bit more high end or upscale. And they started with one location and eventually brought a second location on. But what was interesting in this particular business and the industry is that at the time, I didn't realize how value or how important gift cards were to this type of industry. And these folks, probably at least a third of their annual sales every year were in gift card sales, which was a pretty significant amount, you know, when you're talking a couple $1 million in sales. And what, and really those end up being, they're considered to be contingent liabilities on the balance sheet. And when it comes time to sell businesses like this, you know, a lot of times sellers and even brokers don't consider that up front. And in our case, we somewhat had, but we maybe didn't pay enough credence to it. But in this case, the seller was able to show me very quickly that he kept meticulous records. He probably had 10 years of records of, you know, for each year of how many gift cards they sold, how many were redeemed, and the amount that were outstanding. And of note in Florida is that gift cards never expire. So, you know, even the gift cards from 10 years ago that were still outstanding, those theoretically could come back someday to be redeemed.
Okay, so let's understand this a little bit. So we have a situation here where it's a successful business doing millions of dollars a year in business. Substantial part of their business is in gift cards. And I would imagine in this type of business, the gift cards are around Christmas, maybe up through Valentine's Day.
Yeah, really, it ended up being right after Thanksgiving up to about Valentine's Day. They probably sold 80% of that amount were probably sold in that short time frame. And then probably well over half to 75% were probably redeemed from the Christmas time frame to maybe Mother's Day. So, you know, the sale, you know, so everything happened pretty much from say late November till Mother's Day in May, you know, the sales and the redemption. The vast majority, that's when it happened.
Well, traditionally in the spa business during the holidays and things like that, it's not the booming time of year for them. So that was probably a good cash flow item for them.
Yeah, it turned out, you know, that was, you know, come after Mother's Day when, you know, down here in Florida, you know, the summers are pretty slow for most businesses. And that's the money that they relied upon to get them through the summer months typically, you know, as their sales decrease somewhat. So it was very important to the business.
Well, it's interesting then what we have here is this whole concept of a contingent liability, and generally contingent liabilities are a big negative to a buyer. And in most situations, any financial advisor would probably tell you that contingent liabilities, especially in the hundreds of thousands of dollars, is going to decrease the value of your business. And this is the kind of situation that you had. So did that actually happen then in this situation where this hundreds of thousands of dollars of contingent liability up there made it difficult to sell the business?
You know, we really thought it would. We were pessimistic. You know, we were optimistic, but also pessimistic. And it came to be that one of the very first buyers, it was a husband and wife team that inquired. Actually, they were very educated. It was two lawyers from Minnesota that were tired of living in Minnesota and were tired of being lawyers. And it just so happened that one of their fathers owned a CPA firm. So they actually, you know, did a little bit prior to being under contract and in due diligence. They asked some questions that the seller was comfortable answering. So he put his CPA in touch with one of the buyer's father's firm, gave him some comfort, and got to the contract phase and then got in due diligence. And, you know, as you mentioned, there was probably about $350,000 or $400,000 of contingent liability that at the end of the day, because of the meticulous records that were kept, that they felt comfortable actually assuming those liabilities. And they did.
Well, the reason that I think record keeping here would be especially important is because if you didn't know the redemption rate, and, you know, gift cards traditionally have a 10 to 15% no redemption component.
Breakage.
And I assume that that held up here too.
Yes. Yep. They were able to show that, you know, every year, you know, and then they also could show of those years, you know, that, you know, if it was from 8 years ago, they actually had the records to show that, you know, that, you know, four gift cards from 8 years ago got, you know, whatever that might be, but they even had that type of record keeping that they could show from the years past you know, in that current year, if any got redeemed or not. So, yeah, so the record keeping was super important.
So the actual contingent liability, even though, you know, you have 10 years of gift card sales, they were able to track of what the outstanding amount would probably never be redeemed. And for those that were still on the books, when they would likely be redeemed, because they could predict based on their data that they had accumulated over time. And that traditional contingent liability was not as big a deal as most people would make it out to be without the type of records like that, because it would be a big question mark.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. And they felt very comfortable with it. And once again, a lot of times a deal like that might have some type of price reduction as well. And they didn't ask for a price reduction. So the sellers, you know, they got their pretty close to full price offer, and they were able to walk away happy.
So you have a multi-million dollar day spa with a couple of locations here. And generally speaking, contingent liabilities are a big issue in the sale of any business, because it's generally a question mark. And that's why they're called contingent. They can't pin down exactly what that liability is going to be. But in this case, because of the data that they'd have accumulated, the contingent liability, such as gift cards, with detailed records really minimize the impact of the contingent liability on the sales price.
Yes. Yep, exactly.
Well, that's very cool. What could have been a big challenge was muted because of some very insightful owners. So why don't we move over to some transactions then that you've had that really worked out well for the sellers and the buyers?
Well, we had another deal. We'll call it a construction company that was located in the Tampa area. It had been a family, it was a family run business that had 30 plus years. The owner that I dealt with had actually been in business with his father at one time. His father stepped out probably about 30 years before. So the owner I dealt with had owned the business for about 30 years.
But it had experience in the business even longer than that.
Yes. Yep. So he had, you know, close to 40 years in this particular industry. And was, you know, getting in his early 70s and was time to retire. And we actually found him through we do some direct mail in our office, and he had received a direct mail letter and kept it in his desk for actually a couple of years, and got to the point where he pulled it out of his desk one day and gave me a call, and we got together, and we asked the questions and the things that we do, and it came to find out that he was doing another multi-million dollar business, and had meticulous books and records. This was one of the few times I actually got reviewed financials. Most of the especially Main Street businesses, we don't see that very often. He paid his accountants to do some level of scrutiny or diligence on his financials every year that produced a report that came out, and came out later when we actually found a buyer and even the banks for SBA lending that it really gave them comfort in those reviewed financials.
Yeah, a review of financial statements is just short of an audit. I mean, it's very detailed, and they verify accounts and without going into a full audit. So as you said, it's very unusual for a company to have reviewed financial statements just short of, being an audit. So that's quite impressive that an owner like that, especially someone that I would consider of the old guard, I guess, been in business for 30 years, would have that type of accountability with his accounting.
Yeah, and what was interesting is that he did not just do this before selling. He had been doing it for years. So there were multiple years of those types of records that really did help out when it came time to the due diligence later.
Well, anytime you can provide data and mountains of data, it reduces the perceived risk in a transaction and takes a lot of unknowns off of the table. And reviewed financial statements will certainly do that, especially to bankers. And you said this was an SBA loan transaction?
It was. It was. And it really did help later when we found, once again, we probably had only had the business listed for maybe not even 2 months, and a prospective buyer from out of state contacted us, and we provided once they contact us, just like any other broker, or what sellers could expect is that your broker will disclose a potential buyer. So we have them sign a non-disclosure agreement and a buyer profile that has a personal financial statement. And then once we deem that person to be pre-screened, we share with them the additional information that we put together with the seller's help. In this case, we call it a confidential business review. And our sellers, they got that document and came in on a Saturday, I believe.
Where did they come in from?
The buyers actually came in from Louisiana. It was a husband and wife, and they both worked in corporate America and were probably in their late 40s or early 50s. And they were tired of working, you know, in the corporate environment, and they wanted out. And they saw this business, and it was, you know, they had no experience in the construction industry, which, you know, is interesting. We'll talk a little bit later.
So what kind of business were they in?
The husband actually was in the printing industry. So he worked for a big printing company, and the wife actually worked for like a court reporting business. So they had, you know, no direct experience, but they had business experience.
So why do you think they were interested in a construction business when that generally is attractive to contractors, not people outside of the construction industry?
Well, I think in our confidential business review, we were able to show, you know, it was the financials. It was the amount of money that the business was making, and it didn't have a lot of add backs. I mean, it was almost all of the cash flow or discretionary earnings was from the owner's salary and the net income of the business. There weren't a lot of owner's perks. So that was very attractive that they knew the numbers were very strong. And then also in the write-up, we'd mentioned that they were reviewed financials. So that was a big thing right off the bat. And then we also were able to document in this confidential business review that the business had well-placed policies and procedures in place, and that the owner was not responsible for anyone. He didn't have anything that he was responsible for in the business, where a lot of times a business owner might be the primary salesperson or estimator or something like that. In this case, this seller was not, he didn't have anything that he was responsible for. He would take off for, you know, a month or two at a time and go on vacation, and the business still ran fine.
So it sounds like in this particular situation, the owner had done a lot of things right, but specifically, he could show that the business could go on without him, and he had put together and assembled a management team that could operate the business as good as he could, and maybe in some cases even better.
Yeah.
And when a buyer is looking at something like that, that's a pretty attractive situation that you don't normally get in mid-market businesses. And this business sounds like it was doing $3-5 million of business a year from what you've described. And that would mean that there's a pretty healthy cash flow there.
Yes, it was. And that, I think, you know, between the cash flow and the financials and the fact that the owner was not, you know, that he wasn't intimately involved in any particular detail of the, you know, and for the day-to-day operations, that made it very appealing to these particular buyers.
So in this particular situation, buyers outside of the construction industry could really see themselves running this business because they had a team around them that understood the business,
yeah,
and could manage the business. And it sounds like coming out of corporate America, they were probably pretty good managers.
Yeah. And I think one other key that I'd like to address with potential sellers is that in this case, the owner was the primary, this required a contractor's license. And, you know, in Florida and maybe other states, there's specialty contractor license, but this was a full-blown contractor's license. And the seller was the primary license holder, but he also had his general manager get the license. So when it came time to actually go get into the process with the SBA, some of the first banks that we, probably four or five banks that we dealt with, that it wasn't an SBA policy, but it was an internal bank policy that, you know, to let this general manager qualify these buyers as the contract license holder, they were going to require this general manager to have equity in the business and then also be a personal guarantor of the loan. We were able to, you know, we shopped it around a little bit, and we eventually found a bank that was, because of the background of the buyers, they were satisfied with an employment agreement. The seller was also willing to stay on board for a year as a backup as well for a license holder. So that was important, though, in that the seller, you know, probably was not purposeful thinking about selling, but the fact that he had a secondary license holder we were able to really expand our buyer search. You know, instead of having to be someone that had a contractor's license at the time, you know, we were able to make that happen. So that's probably a takeaway for somebody that's in that type of a industry of construction, that they may want to consider having an employee or two be backup license holders.
Yeah, just to expand on that a little bit, you know, in the contracting world, the way that works is that in order to do business, whether it's a general contractor's license or an electrical contractor, plumbing contractor, whatever construction niche that you're in, it requires licensing. And generally speaking, the owner of the business holds that license and is required then to sign off on the estimates and be responsible for that. There is something called a responsible managing officer or a responsible managing employee that can hold that contractor's license for the business. But generally speaking, most contracting businesses that I've seen sold, the actual owner holds the contractor's license. And what you're telling me here is that because the owner brought in his manager, who would have been a responsible managing employee in this case, to hold the contractor's license, and he was on the state licensing board's documents as the co-licensee holder for that contractor's license. And what you're saying is because of that feature, either planned or unplanned, it turned out that it was a huge deal in expanding the buyer pool, people that could actually come in and be interested in the business. In this case, it was a guy out of a printing company, a corporate guy, who came in and didn't have any particular contracting experience, but was probably a good manager of the business, was able to make an offer on the business, and it probably was able to keep the price at asking, or maybe even a little bit more in this case.
Yeah, we ended up getting pretty much asking price. And I think, you know, we were able to, the particular bank that we ended up using, you know, we were able to convince them, you know, that this particular buyer was more important as a business person. You know, he was, you know, if he was out actually in the field, you know, supervising, you know, installations and such, you know, the business would suffer. You know, he was growing the business, and he has expanded the business quite a bit.
Well, that's, I think, a key point too. Big difference between working in the business and being out in the field every day managing crews versus out there generating business and networking and marketing the business. A far more important role if you have people, as this business did, that could manage the operation side of the business. It's a good combination. A lot of businesses never get to that level where they can step up and achieve that, where they have built a management infrastructure that facilitates that type of process. So it sounds like everything worked out for this owner. He got what he wanted for the sale of the business and was able to exit the business successfully.
Yes. Yep. We, like I mentioned earlier, we pretty much got very close to full asking price. And this, you know, at the end of the day, both parties were very happy with the transaction.
All right. Well, you've had some good takeaways here. I think anyone that's listening to the podcast can look at some of the takeaways here and note them for future reference. If some of our audience would like to reach out and chat with you, how would they get a hold of you?
Well, they could reach me on my email. My email address is tbellon, B-E-L-L-O-N, at vrsouthshore.com. www.vrsouthshore.com.
All right. You can easily find information on Tim on our website, businessexitstories.com. Well, Tim, thank you for being here. I appreciate your time and taking the effort to put together some of the transactions that you've dealt with in the past for the benefit of our audience here. So until next time, this is Marvin L. Storm, host here at the Business Exit Stories podcast. We'll have another episode out in the next week. So join us again for some more interesting business exit stories.
Thank you, Marvin.
Join us in our next episode when our guests will share more stories of how entrepreneurs, founders, and business owners have exited their businesses and learn about what to avoid and what you need to do to successfully position your business for a successful exit. If you enjoyed this podcast, take a minute to give us a rating on iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcasts so aspiring entrepreneurs everywhere can find us. If you wish to reach out to any of our guests, please visit our website at www.businessexitstories.com, where you can find more information. Join us next time for more Business Exit Stories.